Jesus commanded his followers to occupy until I come. I don't think this is what he meant by that. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy, Barry Sheets. And along with me today is our Vice Chairman, my good friend, and historical support, Chuck Michael.
Well, it's going to be interesting today, I think, so I'm glad to be here.
Well, I think it is, too. Ladies and gentlemen, we're believers. The vast majority who are listening to this program are believers in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. We know that Christ gave commands to his followers. One of those commands from Scripture is to occupy until I come. Now, for some, that means, okay, we're supposed to be good believing Christians and sit down and, you know, go to church and do all the things and be good people, but we kind of turn a blind eye to what's going on in our culture. On the other hand, that idea encompasses going out and actively pursuing righteousness and the grace of God and advancing his kingdom through all areas of our life. Now, oftentimes you will see throughout history, throughout the Bible, that there are those who would, as the scriptures say, would sneak in unawares and try to lead people astray. Jude talked about those who were in the church, who were denying the faith, and who were actively seeking to change the gospel. Well, we have a new religious movement. I'm going to state that today, and people, you can push back on me if you want to, Chuck or anybody else. I believe we have a new old religious movement that has launched in America. And they, too, believe in the command to occupy. But, Chuck, as you know, and I think most people are guessing, those folks, their religion is secular humanism. Their religion is the old pagan worships. And how they are planning to occupy is through revolution. I'm talking about the admixed cadre of radicals and young people and others who are making up the, we now find, not just spontaneous expression of opposition to all things American that is known as, well, started out as Occupy Wall Street, because it was supposed to be a reaction by the common man against the 1%, the wealthy, the big bankers, those who had quote unquote power. But Chuck, I think as we're looking at this, and the longer this goes and more people are looking in and investigating it, we're realizing that this Occupy movement has some other agendas rather than just bringing to light and to public information, maybe some disparities or inequalities in the way we handle our economic life in this country.
Well, and that's partly because the entire movement is built on a flawed perception of what's going on in the nexus between government, big finance, and those kinds of things. And that is some kind of a strange idea that the problem is deregulation. That's basically Dr. Tom Woods has done an expose in a couple of his books, one of them being Meltdown, and the other one being, I think, Rollback.
I think both of them, listeners can go to principlepolicy.com if they would like to order copies of those books.
I think so. In any case, Dr. Tom Woods has exposed what's been going on in that nexus insofar as it's not a matter of deregulation, it's a matter of regulation. Now, what the Occupy Wall Street people, and I like the fact that you brought up the idea that it is a religious belief. And the high priesthood of this religious belief is the idea of big government being providential and being a savior figure. And the other idea is that you're right, in humanistic, basically humanism, that is the idea of self-worship. So basically, the high priest is big government who is going to act as a salvific figure, and big government and the self, who is the real source of all things good and all things lawful and all things all morality.
Or to quote and phrase a popular country song from the 80s, Mr. Roosevelt is going to save us all.
Yeah. And you and I, knowing the history of the Great Depression, we realize that Hoover and Roosevelt worked together to basically turn what should have been a 2-year, rather serious downturn, economic downturn, as had happened in 1921. Mm-hmm. And Warren G. Harding actually did solve the problem by actually not just doing nothing, but cutting taxes and cutting regulation. But Roosevelt and Hoover basically combined to turn a 2-year downturn into a 17-year economic nightmare.
Absolutely. And folks, the same scenarios are being played out today. We didn't get to the point of the economic collapse in 2008 just because, now, and I'm not going to absolve them completely of any culpability or complicity in this, but it wasn't solely because of corporate CEOs taking their share options or getting great buyouts or golden parachutes. Yes, that's part of the sickness, the illness that was in our economy. But a bigger part of it was from government deciding that they were going to choose winners and losers. They were going to regulate how, when, where, why, and to what extent free trade could happen. See, that the whole moniker of free trade or free commerce, i.e. the basis of the Western system of capitalism, is turned on its ear when government decides it's going to pick winners and losers by regulation. We saw the buildup of that as the government had to step in. They had to do something about the Enrons of the world or the WorldComs or things of that nature. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the cure, I believe, as we're starting to see it take shape, is worse than the disease. It's on the one end, having those who would game the system, so to speak, is not right. It's not just. However, nationalizing industries, writing big subsidies for particular preferred entities like Solyndra and others, and having them basically rob the American people of their tax dollars that government is taking from us in a greater and greater amount every year. That's a worse condition than what we started with.
Right. Basically, what you've got is companies that come in with the flavor of the month on what government subsidies should go to, and get $500 million, that's $500 million, folks, $500 million worth of loans that then go bad, giving the executives golden parachutes, and everybody else basically gets left holding the bill.
Yeah.
Let me give you a small illustration. This isn't where we're going today, but I'll give you a small illustration from my own industry. I own a company that designs and distributes dietary supplements. For years, basically, the FDA has been claiming that we're an under-regulated industry, and I always laugh about that. That's a joke. I've had visits from the FDA, so I know we're not under-regulated. That being said, what's going on in my industry is that the small guys like me, I'm a very small player. I have a very small niche market. We are being forced out of the market through regulatory cost. And by that, I mean there is some testing that is being required that we were doing voluntarily anyway. But there is other testing that's being required that is redundant and very pricey and very paperwork laden. For instance, you have to do raw material testing, which is fine. Nobody's squawking about that. Then you have to do what's called a mix test. And once you put your raw materials together, you have to pull a sample and make sure it's a homogeneous sample and all that. Then you have to test it in process, and then you have to test it again after it goes in the bottle. Those last two tests are completely redundant. Why you need to test something after it's in the bottle, after you've tested the homogeneous mix while it's going in the capsule or in the tablet, is an absurdity. But it's there to try to run the cost up. Now you have to generate all this paperwork. You basically have bottling regulations. You can't just simply set up a bottling line in a clean room. Oh no, you have to keep absolute records about all kinds of peripheral things. And what it actually does is it causes guys like me to either contract that out at a higher cost or do it ourselves and put in the equipment, which sounds like it should be a stimulus to the economy. But believe me, once you buy a bottling line, you're going to make it run for 30 years if you can when you're at our level.
Exactly, because you have to recoup your sunk costs and your fixed
costs. Oh, absolutely. And it would take that long at our level to do that. So basically what the government is saying, and there's a couple reasons for that, having also worked in the pharmaceutical industry. The FDA likes dealing with big companies because when it comes retirement time, they are basically told tacitly, and I don't think that if there's anybody who works in the drug industry who would deny this, the fact is what happens, the FDA comes and says, you know, if you hire so-and-so, it might be easier on you from a regulatory standpoint because they're retiring and they need a little extra income as a consultant. Now, I know you're a consultant, but you don't get to twist arms like that. But the FDA does it regularly. And, you know, I may get put out of business for even saying this, but the fact is everybody knows it goes on. We've all seen it happen. And any of us who worked on the corporate side rather than the small business side. And the FDA knows it would be a waste of time to come and ask us to hire an FDA consultant because, A, most of us are making money in such a way that we can pay our salaries and little else. So we have no money to hire consultants. Okay. But that's what the way the industry works.
Right. Well, and the point is that you brought up a couple of good points here that something we ought to think about, and we're going to come back around to why we have people camping out in little tent cities in front of various places like the Port of Oakland and the Wall Street and yes, the State House in Columbus, Ohio. But you bring up a couple of good points. And one is that I believe a lot of people who otherwise, you know, are relatively satisfied with their where they are in life and the salaries and the income. I know nobody's ever satisfied with the salary you make. You always want to make more. That's fine. But I think oftentimes the public gets disengaged from the fact that in order to have products at the stores and the big box shopping centers to buy, there are individuals, families, business groups that come together to put resources and money into starting a business and sinking lots of their hard-earned capital into things like that bottling machine you were talking about, where it's a huge fixed upfront cost that in order for it to be able to not end up becoming a sea anchor and destroying them, they have to make it profitable. They have to either have enough quantity coming out or the right kind of thing. So in other words, they have to be responsive to the market, but they also have to take risks. And
well, that's right.
Thank God in this country, we do have some limited form of free market capitalism left that people are who do take risks and who set out to provide products and services to their fellow man. Yes, oftentimes maybe that heart motive is I want to get rich. But there's nothing wrong with that. So, you know, I'm going to say right now, I'm not of a Marxist mentality. I don't set a point at saying, well, that guy over there's, you know, he made $10 million this year. You know what? That guy sitting over there may be 75 years old. And he may have invested every dime he had in his young family savings to get that company that now is paying him $10 million off the ground who are making and providing necessary products that improve, help, and maybe even in some cases, like maybe in your industry, save people's lives. I'm not going to sit here and be jealous and covetous and break God's commandments by saying, yeah, that guy over there, he doesn't deserve what he's got. He's that 1%. And fairness would say that we must take everything he has and divvy it up among the rest of the 99%. And that's why I'm getting right back around to Occupy Wall Street, because that's the entire mentality. It's based on Marxist, secular humanist philosophies.
And Marxism is based on a violation of the 10th commandment, and that is, thou shalt not covet.
Absolutely.
And that is the bottom line. The big lie here is that there is no ambition involved in the leadership of Occupy Wall Street for anything other than a quote-unquote fair society, and that's why you and I have kind of squawked on the idea of a fair society in the past. There is no such thing as a fair society.
No, we can have equality of opportunity, but when you start talking about fair in the sense of equality of outcome, then you're talking about socialism and leading into Marxism.
And that's where the big lie lies. The guys who are out in front, who are leading the charge, who are making the plans, who are making the big speeches and getting all the troops rah-rahed up, the fact is, rather than a multi-tiered society like we have in the United States, where there are interactions between the classes and you can move from one class to another.
Chuck, I'm going to stop you right there. Okay, God, I love you. I love you, brother. But when we all start talking about classes, upper class, middle class, lower class, we're being cultural Marxists, because that was the whole basis of Marxism, was to break society up into classes, to pit classes, supposed classes against each other. Now, I think we ought to try to use some different phrasing in that. And I'm not trying to be critical of you. So, ladies and gentlemen, don't get me wrong.
I understand.
Chuck and I are not getting into a fight here. But the point is that we need to think about the fact that we have people who try to be productive. We have people who are very successful at being productive, and we have people that are not so successful at being productive. But the point is, we each ought to have the opportunity in this society to, if we are moved and driven to do something, to be able to at least have the opportunity to do so. Now, we cannot guarantee the outcome. We can't guarantee that the 99% will all be driving Lexuses but the point is that the fact remains, that's not what Occupy Wall Street's about. And I'm going to let you get back to your thought, though. But I just want to throw that in.
Okay.
That whole class idea is one that really just has always rankled me, because it is a unconscious, we have been indoctrinated in this culture to believe in classes so that we could be set up to believe in a class struggle.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's part of this picture. And the fact is that from a worldview standpoint, even people who are trained in looking at things from a Christian worldview perspective occasionally fall into the language and the thinking pattern about class distinctions.
Yes.
And the fact is, in the United States, we don't really know what class distinctions are. And that is because you can move from a trailer to into a McMansion someplace. If you could have a great idea and know how to sell it and have the wherewithal and the guts and the stick-to-itiveness to sell that idea to somebody who helps you build the plant or helps you hire the workers, that helps you produce the product, that helps you make the money to move into the McMansion.
That's right.
And so there we have income mobility in this country, and you can just as easily lose it by resting on your laurels and saying, I'm going to make this amount of money forever, and not working to continue to, because as everybody knows, things change very rapidly. The things that made money and were highly successful in 2000 aren't doing too well right now in many cases. Ask somebody who works in the recording industry.
Exactly.
there has been a revolution, if you will. Again, a bad choice of words, but it communicates what I want to say. There's been a revolution in certain kinds of industries, and they're not keeping up very well. And one of those things, you know, we've just watched Blockbuster. Who thought Blockbuster was ever going to go out of business? Well, the Blockbuster in my neighborhood is torn down, and it's a bank now.
Yeah, there are still a few hanging on in various areas of the country, but you're right. I mean, that's an incredible. You take business owners, people with ideas, take risks. They step out there, and maybe for a time they're rewarded because that they've caught the needs of the society around them, or they've built a better mousetrap, so to speak. And
well,
so therefore it's great. But then if somebody else comes along and more competition comes into the model and somebody else figures out how to build that mousetrap just a little bit better than the better mousetrap, then you either have to adjust and be able to change your marketing strategy or change the way you're building things, or maybe even swallowing real hard and admitting, okay, we can't best this, so let's figure out if we can build something else. Or you go out of business. I mean, but the point is, our folks at Occupy Wall Street and what is being derisively called, and I even hate using, but I'm going to say it, what they're calling the flea party, that's not what they're about. What they're about is forcing who they see as the powerful. And they've got, and arguably there are some merits to the fact that those who are in very, very high demand businesses or in banking or things like that have a form of power. But the point is that if people choose to boycott that company or that product, or they choose to buy from a competitor, where's the power at that point? It's with the consumer, the people in society who are making the choices in a free, well, and again, I hate using that term because I know full well our economy hasn't been a free market for quite a while now.
Right.
You know, we still have enough vestiges of it that there is some opportunity available, but we're heading faster and faster into that good night where we've given up our liberties and our freedoms in exchange for a little security, and we're heading into socialist controls of the economy and the market. I mean, you look at the bailouts of GM, look at
right.
These preferential treatments of the quote unquote green industries in this country, the $500 million to Solyndra. And, you know, it's interesting you brought that up because what a lot of folks don't realize is that when the bottom fell out of the Solyndra deal, There was a move on by the administration, by the Obama administration. They had another $400+ million that they were going to hand over to this company. It would have totaled over $1 billion in your tax money going to one particular company who happened to be big donors to the Obama administration. Surprising how
well
that works.
That's the problem with crony capitalism. Let's go back to the point I was making here for a minute about the leadership of Occupy Wall Street and all this stuff.
Yes, please.
These guys know full well. Now, we got off on that tangent on class society, but that is exactly what's being created. It's a two-class society. And when I say class, these guys are class conscious, even though we really in our society, my whole point is we are not. They are. They know the fact that there are going to be workers and there are going to be people who are members of the party. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because it is the Bolshevik system.
Ah, yes. And I have been saying for a while now that to people who are sitting there, well, what do you think about this Occupy Wall Street thing? I look at them and say, well, yeah, it looks like 1917 about to happen all over again. It's the Bolshevik Revolution just brought to our shores instead of being in Russia.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand is that the communists in Russia weren't even the largest splinter. The largest splinter in Russia during the Russian Revolution were what were called the Social Democrats. people who wanted essentially, they thought they wanted democracy. Of course, they didn't understand what they really wanted. They wanted Republican, they wanted representative Republican government. But they wanted it to be a, where basically the state provided, you know, healthcare and all the usual stuff that goes along with quote unquote social democracy style government. And the fact is what the Bolsheviks did and the Mensheviks who were the other faction of the Communist Party. There were two factions. What they did was they basically allowed the Social Democrats to actually run the revolution. And then when that got a little chaotic, they just stepped in and did a coup d'etat and took hold of the reins of government, and voila, you had rule by the Communist Party in Russia from 1917 until about what, 2000 something? I forget what the dates are now, but you know, it basically is over 80 years of communist running the government. Now, of course, they run it with a mask of social democrat, but the same guys are in charge.
That's true.
That's the joke that, and that's what's really going on here with Occupy Wall Street. These guys are know full well what the stakes are. They know what the goals are, and they're using abuse of the system that was set up, by the way, by the government. The fact is that all the small players, as we talked about, are being forced out rather rapidly in the banking industry. I used to do business with a local bank. Good luck finding a local bank these days. They most of those were forced out during the 1980s and 1990s, and forced in. They were basically forced to be bought out by larger and larger and larger banking corporations by government regulation, and it had nothing to do with the fact that they were insolvent. It had to do with the fact that they weren't big enough.
You know, one of the things that I think people ought to be cognizant of is that the movement, Occupy Wall Street, it isn't just Wall Street. I mean, right now, they're just yesterday, and this may date it a little bit, understood where the group, the occupiers in Oakland, California, shut down the port of Oakland. They shut down all shipping into and out of the port of Oakland for an entire day. Now, I'm sorry, what does the shipping in the port of Oakland have to do with Wall Street bankers who are in New York City? So you strip from New York all the way to Oakland, California. What does all that have to do with tent cities setting up in front of the State House in Columbus, setting up near Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton? What's the connectors here? Because obviously it isn't just about the bankers. It isn't just about the quote unquote, the 1%. Honestly, Chuck, you know, as you say, as government is attacking small businesses and really dry, and we know that small business, you know, if you look at the numbers, you look at the history, small business is the backbone of our free market culture. It is the reason why America is thriving and vibrant and growing. We don't have a, you know, our industries are ones that can be cottage industries, ones that start up when grandpa and grandma had a great idea about how to make a better pecan pie. We don't have multi, you know, well, we do have, I guess, now, but what we started with and what built our country were those small businesses. But the attack isn't just, I mean, if you think about Occupy Wall Street, if government is involved in propping up these large industries and actually want to see these consolidations and these multinationals come together because it's a concentration of power, then why would Occupy Wall Street want to attack something that their savior, government, has said is good?
Well, this is a classic a Leninist tactic.
Thank you. I was hoping you'd catch that riff that I was going toward.
Yeah, this is what was called think about it in terms of a vice with the middle, basically what is Joe Average in the middle. You've got pressure from above. in the form of government and corporate partnership. And this is the big idea. You know, you and I have railed for years against this idea of government business partnership. And of course, we've been exposing it for what it is, and that is fascism.
Yes, that's a what we call a politically correct way of talking about fascism is to call it a public-private partnership and to lull the virtues of it, of government coming in and telling private industry what you can produce, when you can produce it, how much you can produce, all for the good of society.
Yeah, and that's a loaded word, and people have put all kinds of meanings that it has nothing to do with. It basically has to do with the idea that that the government allows you the illusion that you own the stock in the company, but they control every aspect of production, including the labor supply. And
harkening back to the conversation earlier this week about Boeing and the National Labor Relations Board and Nancy Pelosi and others wanting to force them to have only union employees in their plants, or else they shouldn't be allowed to build the plant.
And that is fascism. Now the pressure from below is you stir up the people who basically are operating on that jealousy principle. Those horrible guys on the top are forcing our hand and making us come out and demand that the government do something. Well, government's on the top layer. They're just pretending like they're not. In fact, they're working with that upper echelon, and it's applying pressure to the great middle. And the middle, basically being in the middle of a squeeze, isn't really paying close attention to who's turning the handles on the vice. All
right.
They know is all of a sudden the vice, they're in the vice and they don't like it and they would like to be out.
And so what they're going to do is they're going to lean toward one side of the vice or the other to relieve the pressure.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And this is exactly what we see happening here. This is why we see people who are making ridiculous statements like anybody but Obama, and leaning toward electing someone who is basically Obama light, has all the same political characteristics, just has a different letter behind his name. And we've seen this over and over and over. I don't know how many times you and I have talked about the fact that so-and-so we'll go to a meeting and someone will say so-and-so would make a great president. I don't think so. No, yeah. I think he would make a terrible president.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we're not here to pick winners and losers for you. We're not here to say which person would or wouldn't be a good presidential candidate. We're asking you to think. We're asking you to understand what's actually happening beyond the news bites, beyond the 30-second sound bites. We're asking you to delve down into this. You know, what we're seeing here. And the reason why Occupy Wall Street is so bad is not because it's a bunch of radicals or a bunch of disaffected ne'er-do-wells who are out there screaming against the man. This is a concerted effort, Chuck. This is an actually orchestrated and I think very, very timely, and we'll talk about why that's timely in a minute, timely force maneuver in order to get the American public to accede to certain things, to capitulate on various concepts in order to move the ball in the socialist Marxist direction.
Well, that's right. Think about this. Who's the major, where is a lot of the money for Occupy Wall Street come from? This is not a cheap operation. In New York City and in other places, they have kitchens set up where they're feeding these hundreds or thousands or however many people are showing up. They're feeding them for nothing. They're basically trucking in water. Somebody has rented porta potties, although apparently in some places they're not using them. You know, someone has supplied tents. People are not bringing their own tents to this thing. They're coming and they're being assigned to tents that have been set up for them.
So in
that
other
all
words,
costs
money. It's a
that
coordinated effort,
money.
Ladies and gentlemen. It's a coordinated
That's right.
effort.
It's coordinated with somebody who has a lot of money.
Now recently, there was something that popped across the news media that I think helps put another piece of that puzzle together. Chuck, you know, I know you saw this as well. Our old buddy ACORN, the Association for Community Organizers for Reform Now, I think is maybe what their acronym was, and I may have gotten that wrong, but that really makes sense. ACORN, who we thought was dead and buried, Congress had taken away all the money that they were being given, doesn't look like that's happened now, does it? It looks like ACORN's still alive and well, because in New York, where you say all this is going on, a group called New York Communities for Change is scrambling, destroying documents, firing people, trying to hide their connections to ACORN, because that's who ACORN is in New York. It's New York Communities for Change. You see what they did? Just like the left, when you're exposed, what do? You don't be humble and say, yeah, we did wrong, and you quit and stop doing it. You know, you don't like the woman at the well, reform your ways and sin no more. You change your name. You change around a handful of people in your corporate structure. You change your name, and you keep doing exactly the same thing you were doing, but you redouble your efforts. That's what ACORN has been doing, because basically they found out that it's ACORN who's been coordinating through their hired officials these phony protests, to the point of actually, you think these are all just people who are disgruntled and they feel like they need to come together because their voice needs to be heard? No. They're actually paying people $10 an hour up to $100 per day to go and sit in and live in the tents to create a media moment for the change that the upper end of the vice is going to be bringing forward as the solution to the unrest in our country. In other words, more regulation and more control by government.
Well, I've been warning people that this protest is basically, they're trying to keep it going through the winter. It's not going to happen. You and I both know that. People are not going to go live in tents in January when it's, you know, 8 below 0. It's not going to happen. They're all going to go home to mom and dad who, you know, or wherever their trust fund, you know, their trust fund, the apartment it pays for. Because a lot of these kids, as it's been exposed, a lot of these are young people, and a lot of them are trust fund babies. The same problem that you had in the 60s, basically. They've got all this money, and they hate the fact that they've got all this money, and they want to make sure other people get money. So they're basically going to socialize the system so that, you know, apparently everybody's money is going to disappear except theirs. They get to keep their trust fund because, after all, they helped fight the revolution. Now, what I've been telling people is that you wait, this is a warm up. And, you know, we all laughed about things like flash mobs. You know, flash mobs would show up and break into dance and do all these strange things, you know, through a Twitter feed or through some kind of social media. Well, flash mobs really, now I'm not saying everybody that ever participated in a flash mob is going to show up, you know, to help, you know, do a riot. But what I am saying is that flash mobs were a practice run to get people to show up at just a few minutes notice to be soldiers in a fight, you know, a protest or some sort of, you know, political action. And what's going to happen in the spring is going to make what's happened with Occupy Wall Street look like child's play, I think, because this is all warm up. This is all training to get people prepared for a long, very hot summer. Because as you are all aware, 2012 is a presidential election year.
Right now it still is.
Yeah, well, that's right. Because what very easily could happen, and this is the scenario I've painted, is if there is deep chaos, worse than 1968, if you'll recall, those of us who were around in 1968, I was 11 years old, so I remember it very well. If you can make things even hotter than it was in 1968, you could very well get somebody, I think Barack Obama, I think his time is up, but that he would like to be able to continue to do the things that he does, and he would love nothing better than to have an excuse to suspend elections. And we've already heard those trial balloons. We've talked about this before in another show. We've already heard the trial balloons about suspending elections.
As a matter of fact, just a little over a month ago, ladies and gentlemen, the Democrat governor of North Carolina, Bev Perdue, in a speech, I believe she was actually speaking maybe to the Rotary or something of that nature. Yeah, it was to a local Rotary club in Cary, North Carolina, floated the trial balloon. And ladies and gentlemen, her hand after the speech and after the uproar went, and the trial balloon was that because of our economic problems, maybe we should suspend, and she was very careful to say, congressional elections next year. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that was a trial balloon. Look at it. Our economic problems. Oh, what's Occupy Wall Street? Yeah, all the unrest about? Well, it's about the top 1% who control our economy and who have all the power. We need jobs, 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 jobs. What's going on right now? You know, the press is on. Well, Congress has done nothing, and we need jobs. Purdue floats this trial balloon out. All of a sudden, the media picks up on it. Her handlers and her spinmeisters, her press people. Oh, well, she was just joking. Then you listen to the audio. She never changed tone. She never changed pitch. And she never segued. It wasn't like it was a tangent or something she threw in there, like sometimes we do on this program, where an idea comes up to us and we're like, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, let's talk about this. It was a written part of her speech to press a trial balloon. And ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what they did. They pressed a trial balloon to see how the public was going to react to the idea of suspending elections voluntarily. And obviously, there was a lot of pushback. There was an uproar and a howl across the country over this idea of suspending elections. Where does that leave us then, Chuck? Should we have that long, hot summer, or we have, as a union boss, now, Leo Gerard, who is the United Steelworkers International president, went on a liberal radio program this week and said this. First of all, he said that Wall Street occupiers speak for us. They do it all over the country, in all these places, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Oakland, San Francisco, and I would say Columbus, Dayton, etc. He says, what we need is more militancy. He says, I think we've got to start a resistance movement. If Wall Street occupation doesn't get the message across, he says, I think we've got to start blocking bridges and that kind of stuff. And what else he was talking about was not just blocking bridges. We have to occupy the banks themselves. In other words, they're going to try to take over the buildings. Now, this is the president of the United Steelworkers Union. I'm starting to understand why we've got Occupy in Ohio in Columbus, because of the issue, too, that we talked about that's going to be on the ballot next week and everything that's going on there. But the whole point is, Chuck, if we float a trial balloon about suspending elections that isn't received well by the public as a voluntary measure, what's the other way that elections can get suspended in this country?
Oh, well, basically the president comes in, declares a state of emergency, even though there's no constitutional authority to do any such thing, and basically says we're elections are suspended.
In other words, the implementation of martial law.
Martial law.
And that's exactly what we're and ladies and gentlemen, you know, and we're not trying to be fear mongers on this program. So I want to be very clear about that. But what we're saying is Chuck and I are both students of history. We both have an appreciation for how we got here in this country, not just with our founders and the incredible document that documents they left us in the Declaration of the Constitution. But we also have an ability, because we read a lot, okay? We go and we look at newspapers and websites and we read books. We even read books from people that the vast majority of folks wouldn't want to read because they're liberal. You know, they're the leftists. They're, you know, I've read Saul Alinsky. You know, I've read some of those thinkers that are the apostles of this new religion, which is actually an old religion of paganism and humanism. And I've read some of the things that they suggest. And ladies and gentlemen, this is textbook. This, what's going on right now with these groups and, you know, and the combinations of these various things with labor unions and disgruntled college students who've all been fed on leftist Marxist materials in their college classes or maybe even their high schools, God forbid, but we know it does happen.
It does happen. That's why I homeschooled my kids.
Exactly. Late in 60s radicals and later radicals who all are pushing for a common goal, which is for America to lose its lampstand, for it to stop being that shining city set upon a hill, that bastion of democracy, which it's not. It's actually a constitutional republic.
Yeah.
But
I'm glad you choked on that
word.
Yeah,
I choke on that word because we're not a democracy. And that's the key, folks. That's really where they want to get us to. They really want to get the true, quote-unquote, democracy. Okay, because if that happens, if we become a truly a democracy, we will shortly become a socialist and then a communist nation. Right now, where's the money coming from? Where's Acorn getting their money? Congress cut them off. Where did they get their money? Acorn is funded in part by multi-billionaire George Soros. You're going to start seeing Soros' name come up a lot in all of these, the unions and where they're getting their monies to do all these things and to launch all these efforts. I think if once we were able to look at the books and post issue two, regardless of what happens with it next week, I think you're going to probably find a lot of money coming in from places all over the country that if you really dug and started linking back, you're probably going to find links to Soros-backed organizations who are paying for the 527 ads or who are directly funding the campaigns in order to keep the uproar going.
Where did Soros make his money?
You know, I forget exactly.
Okay.
Go
this
ahead.
This is very important because George Soros made his money by manipulating and in many cases destroying currencies.
That's right. Yes.
He was a currency speculator. Now that means that everyone was aware that somebody was in the market buying up or selling or investing in certain kinds of quote unquote, centralized government currencies.
Right.
George Soros is fully aware of what he has been doing. He is fully aware of what the power of government, especially with a centralized economy, can do. And George Soros is working diligently to use his knowledge of how economic systems work to bring them down with the goal of eventually uniting them in a worldwide economic system.
That he would have the control over because he owns the vast majority of shares of the currency markets in the world.
Well, but he's pretty old and he knows he's not going to be in personal control. But the fact is, he's an ideologue, and this brings this idea of a religious belief. We'll circle back around to that. This is a faith type movement. These people have a faith in big government. In the idea of a unified society, completely worldwide unified, and what that would be able to do for the earth.
Yeah, but you know what? If you have a new religion and the old religion has a quote-unquote religious document, don't you need to rewrite the document?
Well, of course.
And that's where we're getting to with the press. And we found out recently that one of the ground-level organizers to start this whole thing with Occupy Wall Street, a guy by the name, and I can't even pronounce it because it's like I think it's an Eastern European name, Cynic Junger, who's a multimillionaire, has created a new pack called Wolf Pack. What's Wolf Pack's one goal? To raise money to get a constitutional convention convened in the United States of America for the purpose of handling our economic problems. Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming full circle. In order for those in the new religion to destroy that last bastion, that shining city on a hill. And again, please don't get me, don't mistake that I'm equating America with God's own only country, because I'm not being an American civic religionist, but I'm using an analogy. If you're going to create a new religion, you have to have a new religious document, a new Bible to go by. The old Bible, the U.S. Constitution, which creates as a limited constitutional representative republic with checks and balances upon the executive. We've heard Obama talk about how he wished he didn't have to deal with Congress. They could just do everything by executive order. So now it's coming full circle. Many of the organizers are funding efforts to drive to get the United States to have a constitutional convention so they can totally scrap and rewrite the document.
And that's why a lot of this movement, this supposedly conservative movement to get a new constitutional convention, when you begin to look and try to see where the money's coming from to fund all this big movement, because big bucks are being spent to get conservatives to call for a constitutional convention.
That's correct.
Suddenly the trail ends. You cannot find out where the money's coming from. Yeah, and I would invite state legislators to ask the groups like the Goldwater Institute and groups like ALEC, where is the money coming from to fund this effort? And because it's obviously coming from a grant. Who's the grant from? We would like to know. I think that's a legitimate question, and I think it's one that has to be answered, and one I think we're more than justified in asking. Where's the money coming from?
That's right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, to conclude today, we don't have to sit in fear and trembling of the upheavals that are going on in this country. What we have to do is we, as believers, have to do what Christ has told us to do. We must occupy till he comes. That means we have to be ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that's in us. We have to be apologists, ladies and gentlemen. We have to be able to go out and speak the truth of God's word into our culture. We have to hold to the Bible and what it says. We also have to hold to the documents that have kept the America alive and prosperous in a single form of government for over 225 years, the United States Constitution. Now, I'm not putting those two things on a par together. I'm not saying that the Constitution is equal to Holy Writ. What I'm saying is, ultimately, our standard is God's word. Our standard is for us to speak clearly into our culture, to, as Christ said, to occupy. Because occupy in the Greek is a military term. It means to be there and control for the regent. Who's the regent? It's Jesus Christ. We're to occupy. We're to speak back into this, and not speak back in the way that the handlers want you to speak, as in, oh, well, you know, this is just, we just need to elect, Joe, whoever, Republican or anybody but Obama, and that'll take care of our problems. You know, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is that we're not nonpartisan, we're bipartisan. We know that there are significant problems in both parties, of major parties in this country, and in many of the minor parties. So don't get us wrong there either. But the point is that ultimately our allegiance is not to a party. Our allegiance is not to a social structure. Our allegiance is to Christ Jesus. And it is through his word and through us being faithful occupiers in this culture, in this time that we've been placed, to look at the issues, to see them clearly, to put the pieces together and to ask the questions and to bring the answer back that Pilate asked Christ. What is truth? With a resounding answer of Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. That's where we need to go to. We need to not be played in this vice. We need not to lean toward either being radicals on the one end calling for revolution, or radicals on the other end calling for government to just come in and take care of all of it for us. We need to take self-government and self-responsibility, responsibility for our families, responsibility in our own communities, and also to call our elected officials for responsibility in that context. that's how we are going to have a brighter tomorrow.
And we are out of time. So we will see you Monday at 5:30. Thanks for being with us on Principles and Policies. And now, here's a constitutional moment with the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The passage I just read, of course, is from the most well-known freedom document in the world, our Declaration of Independence. Now, many of you, as I was reading it, were reciting it with me. That's because somewhere, most probably as a child, you were taught its importance and were instructed to memorize it. However, the idea of learning about our freedom documents has fallen out of favor in our government schools and has been neglected in our families, our churches, and our communities as well. Regrettably, more and more as Americans, we know less and less about where we come from. You might think of history as a mall map that gives contextual meaning to the little red arrow that says, "You are here." If you could, for a moment, imagine walking into a big shopping mall and seeing the big mall directory map in front of you, and it's totally blank. Nothing on it but the little red arrow and the little red dot. It would really be less than useless to you, wouldn't it? It's the same with the study of our American history. Knowing about the deeds of those who have gone before us tells us where we are on the map of history. But what's more, knowing the beliefs they shared, their faith, their motives, gives us a clue as to who we are. So please, don't let anybody, in the name of multiculturalism or anything else, steal your American history from you or talk you out of caring about it. This has been Michael Anthony Perutka for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American view. In a recent news clip, President Obama was promoting his new energy scheme. Essentially, the president was exhorting Congress to exceed its constitutional authority under Article 1, Section 8, and then to concede that authority to him. During his remarks, President Obama said that we Americans can't be afraid of the future. Well, this got me to thinking. The president's argument seems to be that if Congress or the American people don't go along with this unprecedented power grab, then we are somehow small-minded or paranoid or perhaps victims of some irrational fear of normal everyday adjustments in public policy. But what we are witnessing is not some normal everyday adjustment in public policy. By all appearances, it is a conspiracy to overthrow our system of government. That system was founded on the belief that God created human beings and endowed them with rights, and that civil governments are established by human beings for the purpose of protecting those rights. Now, it's well noted throughout history that governments have a tendency to become the usurper of the very rights they were established to protect. Throughout history, men have had to rise up and defend their country from its own wayward and immoral government. This seems to be just such a time. And so we must call upon our governor to resist and oppose the unconstitutional actions of the federal government. We must call upon local judges to uphold their oath of office to the Constitution. No, Mr. Obama, we are not afraid of change, but like our forefathers, we have a healthy fear of those who gain control of our government and use the power of government to break the law rather than to uphold the law. This is Michael Anthony Perutka for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American view. Things are moving very fast now. A socialist nationalist revolution is almost complete. But there are signs that the American people are finally waking up. In recent town hall forums, both President Obama and U.S. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania have faced irate crowds challenging the wisdom of the government takeover of the American healthcare system. From the tone of the questions, it seems clear that people are fed up with government intervention into their lives. From the content of the questions, it seems clear that people are learning the truth about what their elected representatives are up to. In other words, they've read the healthcare bill even if their congressman hasn't. They have read about death boards and compulsory end-of-life counseling and mandatory coverage that makes the old joke about "we're from the government, we're here to help you" no longer very funny. They are mad, and they ought to be. But we must point out again that what's really wrong with this bill is that the federal government has no authority to do any of this. Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution prohibits the Congress from spending any money on health care. Congress has no authority to do any of the things listed in the health care bill, even if they were helpful, which they are not. And all the blah-blah about whether they are good or bad is a distraction from the primary point. The breathtaking speed with which the auto industry and the banking industry and the insurance industry and the healthcare industry are being nationalized is revolutionary. Obama and his helpers seem to be in a hurry to complete the revolution before Americans fully realize that this is a revolution. This is Michael Anthony Perutka for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American view.